Mr. Condren, Reel 5.
Well, we were attacked by lice, bed bugs and crabs and you name it, we had it. I remember one occasion I was... we used to have little contests, lice-killing competitions, and we'd sit around and we'd be counting up. You'd catch these lice and you'd squash them between the two thumbnails, you see. And sort of 233, 234. And I remember at one point, as I say, it was very difficult to keep clean. And I remember one point I sat there and I looked at my two thumbs and my thumbnails were just encrusted with black blood, my blood. And it was also deeply ingrained that I just looked at them and I wondered if there had ever come a point in my life when I could be totally rid of that. It was almost what I saw as becoming a permanent fixture. That was the situation. But, so you got used to it. You just, it was many, many months. I suppose it wasn't until I was a prisoner about 6 months when we moved eventually to another camp that the... we had facilities for delousing, and they made some arrangements. But you just lived with it, and it's amazing what the human body can put up with. I think we Marines, the Marine commanders, we were probably more fortunate than some, in the sense that we had been we'd had a fairly good training, and. A large amount, I think, of the training that you get, as, you know, as a commander, I think a lot of it is geared to produce not only a physical toughness, which is easy enough to produce with anybody given an average physique and stamina and so on, you can get that. But I think if I look back on a lot of our training, although it was a pain in the neck at the time, was to produce a kind of mental toughness, because. If one talks in terms of toughness or stamina or fortitude, to me it's all between the ears. It's what's in your mind, given a reasonable physical level. And in addition to that, there's also a kind of comradeship or esprit de corps, like I was talking about before, whereby we always helped one another. If there were few occasions where you might be able to steal a little bit of food, a few beans or a few grains of rice or something, we tended to share. If we were ever given a cigarette by one of the guards or something, we shared it. Even if we were on our own, we took it back and we shared it with our friends. Wasn't always the case with the Americans. They tended to be... to look after themselves, and the devil take the hindmost. Not in every case, and again, the American Marines were better because they probably had been trained in a similar way to us and tended to stick together. But that was the situation. So, you know, you struggled through and you hoped for the best. We set up certain little rules and regulations amongst ourselves. For instance, one thing that became taboo was talking about food. Food you just didn't talk about. Because we were starving. We were getting each day. There was no meat, no vegetables, nothing. Okay. We had probably the equivalent of the sugar bowl there, two little bowls, an average-sized sugar bowl. You got... Twice a day you had that filled with a grain, sorghum. We didn't know what it was, but we called it barley because it looked a bit like barley. It was a kind of purplish color. But it was, I eventually found out, so what the Chinese call sorghum, or sometimes called gaoliang. I think it's eaten in China in some places as a staple, but most places it's a kind of famine food. I mean, Chinese prefer rice. So each day, once in the morning and once in the evening, we had a bowl of this. We had a limited amount of hot water to drink. I said limited because, again, it was a question of fires and smoke and boiling water, which we collected from a kind of central kitchen. We all just used to go there and we took turns and worked a rota collecting it. And you had little tickets or something with how many people in your squad and... if it was 6 people, 9 people, 20 people, you collected 9 or a respective number of dollops of the stuff. You then took that back to the hut, and that was shared out very, very carefully and very democratically. Whereas on the whole, everybody would get the same number of grains almost each, and you know, everybody kept an eye on that. So we weren't getting much food. We had no medical attention, no medical equipment. We were covered with bugs, and we're all pretty dirty. In the sense that we couldn't wash or do anything. Unshaven, of course, we all grew beards.
Were you actually starving?
I presume so. Again, starvation is a relative term, but if you work out the I don't know, the carbohydrate or protein, you know, that's in a bowl of sorghum, chances were we were. We must all have lost several stones. I don't know, because we'd no way of weighing ourselves. But I suppose we must have been down to about 6 or 7 stone, in some cases, from 11, 12 stone.
How did your diet compare with that of your captors?
That's the interesting thing. Because at first it appeared to us, because when we lined up for our food, you see, it was a central kitchen area, okay, run by the Chinese. It wasn't run by prisoners. It was later on. In the other camp. At that time it was Chinese. They had one or two big cooking pots where the stuff was cooked up in. Okay. They used to line up and queue up with us to draw the food. And if they had 6 men, they drew for 6 men. If we had 8 men, we drew for 8 men. And at first, we talked about this and we didn't believe it, because to us it was ridiculous. Again, had the positions been reversed, we would have eaten our fill, and the prisoners would have had what was left, okay? And there was no way that we would ever have queued up with prisoners to draw food. They did. At first, as I say, we did not believe it. But we set up a fairly good system of checks and counter-checks for people to watch the kitchens, some of the chaps who were living nearby. And we found out that, on the whole, it was basically true. They were eating more or less the same as we were. Because don't forget that these fires were lit, and the grain was cooked. And then the fires were put out, and the pots were emptied. And there was no other way they could cook anything. If that was in the morning, there was no other way they could cook anything until the evening meal. There was no cheating. You couldn't produce smoke during the day. It was just unthinkable. So in the early mornings, these fires were lit in the dark, and the cooking was all done before it actually got light. So on the whole, as far as we could determine, and we made consistent efforts to find out, we discovered that on the whole, they were eating more or less the same as we were. Exactly the same.
When you say you didn't believe it, do you mean that you thought it was a propaganda stunt?
Not that we thought it was a propaganda stunt, but we thought it was just absolutely stupid. Because, as I say, we wouldn't have done it. In the same way as on the march, we wouldn't have carried heavy weights when, if there was prisoners around, we could have made a carry. You understand? And exactly the same with the food. No, it wasn't. We didn't even think about propaganda in that sense at the time. But again, it's a question of background. You have to understand that Korea was flattened, and there was nothing, and there were very, very short of supplies. We complained on a number of occasions about the lack of food, about the lack of medical attention. And in fact, I had a very serious argument. One, I thought I was going to get into trouble with it, but with a senior Chinese officer. And I quoted a Geneva Convention at him. And he told me, he said that, well, it's unfortunate, he said, that we cannot get medical supplies or more food for you, or even for ourselves. I said, but what we have is going to the front lines where it's desperately needed. Probably true, I suppose, but it made sense. But we didn't really believe it at the time. We thought that they could have pulled out more stops to feed us better. But in many ways, we were eating better than a lot of the Koreans. And many times we stopped and we lived in fairly close quarters to the Korean civilians. sometimes you'd be billeted in a room, or, and they'd be in, they'd be next door when we were on the march. And another thing on the march, I remember that struck me as peculiar at the time. You see, on the march, we'd stop early in the morning. We'd reach they obviously knew where they were going. We'd reach a village. Some of the Chinese had gone ahead, and they would negotiate with the villagers accommodation. So you might have a Korean hut consisting of, say, three rooms. The Korean family living there would evacuate one room and would move into two rooms, okay? So that would be one room where they might, depending on the size, they'd put 20, 30 of us. Usually with us, it was the Marines together, so it was about 20 odd. We tended to, as far as possible, stay together. So you might stay there for a day or two and then move on again, and the same thing. I remember one evening we were leaving, just after it got dusk, just after darkness fell, and we were standing on the road waiting to move off, and the guards were sort of all about and so on. And one of the Chinese officers in charge appeared to be having this furious argument with one of the villagers, presumably the village head or whatever he was. And the argument about it was that the Chinese was offering him food. The Chinese used to carry their supplies in a kind of sausage-like bandolier, which they just strung around themselves. You know, each man might have two or three of these bandoliers of rice or grain or whatever it was. And the Chinese officer had, I don't know, he had half a dozen or so of these bandoliers of grain. And he kept offering them to this old Korean, you see, and the Korean was, we couldn't understand what they were saying. But he was obviously refusing payment. This was the way they paid for our accommodation. This sounds ridiculous, but I'll tell you, it's true. And we stood there for about half an hour while this argument ensued. And eventually, the Chinese, he just took these sort of bandoliers, and he just put them down in the corner of the landing of the house, and just walked off. And the Korean was still arguing that he didn't want them. He said he didn't want payment. But there you are. I mean, the worst stories that we heard were the Koreans and the Chinese didn't get on all that well, or the Koreans saw them as aggressors having come into their country, and so may well be the case. But I can only relate to you what I personally saw, and things which later affected my thinking. You understand me?
Did you ever see personally any evidence of tension between Chinese and Koreans?
I can tell you one case where there was tension. Yeah, there was one occasion when we were on the march, and we were approaching a town. And I think the town was called Kanji. It was a fairly large town. And it was pretty late at night. It must have been about 9, 10 o'clock at night. It was already dark when we were approaching the town. And the town had just been bombed, or strafed, or attacked, either that afternoon or that morning. And houses were burning. There were still bodies lying around. There were people who had been hit by napalm or something. We had to walk through that town. This band of prisoners, about 200 of us, we had to straggle through that town. Before we got to the town, the Chinese stopped us. And they collected everybody together in rather close formation until we were more or less just one big group. They surrounded us with guards, and they fixed their bayonets. That's the way we went through the town. And the Koreans in the town were very, very hostile. They were spitting at us. They threw through various objects at us, rocks, or what have you. They still had their dead lying around, okay? That was one of the few moments in my life when I have been terror-stricken, because I thought they were going to tear us apart. They were screaming and shouting at us in Korean and Japanese. And they appeared to be terrifically hostile to the guards because they couldn't have access to us. Obviously, they blamed us for what they had just been through, and how long they had been subjected to that, I don't know. But
were they men or women?
Both. And mostly all men, or young men. I mean, most Canadians were in the army at the time. So it was a mixture. So I think the Chinese guards also breathed a sigh of relief. And it took us about 20 minutes to walk through this tomb. And it was a pretty horrifying experience. Aside from that, you say evidence of hostility. Nothing really much that I remember. You know, you saw little arguments here and there, but on the whole, they seemed to get along all right. You know,
did they seem to be friendly towards each other?
Generally speaking, yes. Yeah.
Did you have any preference yourself, you and your comrades? Did you have any preference for Koreans or Chinese?
Yes, we preferred the Chinese.
For what reason?
Well, as I said earlier, there were occasions, or in general, the Koreans didn't appear so friendly as the Chinese. And I've told you one case, you know, where I was beaten up, or sort of beaten up, for what I saw as a fairly reasonable cause. But there were other people, other men, not among our Marines, but other Americans who have had stories of being beaten up and for no reason, for no justifiable reason, mostly by Koreans. Some by Chinese, some there were stories, you know, in the Ministry of Defense document, there's several stories by people there who, you know, who claimed to have been beaten up or tortured by Chinese, but it seemed to me that from people I knew, mostly the stories originated with Koreans. And there was a general sort of feeling as to where we felt a little bit happier and a little bit safer if we were with Chinese rather than Korean.
Did you personally witness any instances of ill treatment of your comrades or other people?
No.
Did you personally witness any instances of injustice towards POWs? Unjust treatment?
Well, there was a case later on when we got to Camp 5. I remember when we had sort of organized ourselves, where they had taken some people away for so-called interrogation because of some offense or other. I don't know what they'd been caught doing. And they were supposed to be back in a few hours, but they weren't back in a couple of days, so we all went on strike. The whole camp went on strike until these men came back. We felt that that was not justified.
What form did the strike take?
We just refused to go and answer roll call. And they eventually brought... You see, in this camp, it's very difficult to describe to you, but it wasn't a camp with sort of barbed wire all around. There was some barbed wire up near the gate, but on the whole, you were fenced in by the river and by mountains. So it wasn't a prisoner of war camp in the sense that Stalag 22 or whatever it is was... with barbed wire all around and watchtowers here and there. It was nothing like that at all. It was generally rather open, and the chances of escape were very, very slight, certainly. So we felt that was unjustified, treating people in that way. They eventually brought troops in. They brought a few scores of armed men in, and they lined up on the hill, and I think, if my memory serves me correctly, they fired a few shots in the air. And then we negotiated with the Chinese, and they at first said that, they'd take the men, and they were being held for interrogation somewhere. And we insisted that they bring them back, and they said they wouldn't bring them back. So we decided to call the strike off, because we thought they'd actually attack us. So we sort of gave in a way. But then within a day or so, the men came back. That was all right.
What did they say had happened to them?
Oh, they had just been interrogated. It was for some offense that they'd been accused of stealing food or accused of doing something or other, which, as far as I remember, they weren't guilty of.
Did they say...
Or they weren't the guilty parties.
Did they say how they had been treated under interrogation?
They were just put in a room. They weren't beaten up or anything. Well, they were questioned, but they weren't beaten up.
What did your captors say when you went on strike in explanation of why they hadn't come back?
They were rather annoyed at first. And then we told them, well, you know, that you Marxists believe that this is the only weapon that the working class have, and this is the only weapon that we have. And we sort of turned Marxism around and threw it in their teeth.
How did they respond to that?
They didn't take very kindly to that explanation. They proceeded to say that it was a different kind of setup, that we were prisoners of war, and, you know, it was different. But it worked out, you know, just we sort of gave in eventually. But once you get to know the Chinese way of doing things, things often work out like this. It's a face-saving thing that they made me interested in. In other words, first going on strike, it made them, made the camp commandant or the officers lose face, because he couldn't control the people, you see. So his object was to get us operating in a normal way again, attending roll call. And then his face was saved, so then our face was saved by returning the men. It's the way the Chinese operate.
Who organized the strike? Anybody?
I was one of the people, because I was at that time, at that, you see, this is later on, of course, you know, when we got to Camp 5 and we organized ourselves. That's a whole another story, actually. Because we eventually got the Chinese to agree for us to have our own British company. We were about, I don't know, 150 plus men. And up until that time, we had been spread out among the American companies. And we said that our argument was that if we had our own company, we could look after ourselves and organize ourselves better, which we did. We had committees in the camp which were elected by the men. And we had, as far as I remember, we had two elections. And each time I was voted in as chairman of the company. So we had a committee of about eight people, who were actually voted in by the men themselves. We had ballot boxes, and the Chinese supplied us with sort of cardboard boxes and bits of paper, and we made ballot slips and things like this. And aside from giving us the materials, the Chinese took no part in it. And the counting of the votes, of course, was done very rigorously and very carefully, because the situation was still, you know, I suppose what you tended to do is vote for somebody that you trusted and felt that could either talk to the Chinese or argue with them or get things done. Or, for instance, in the case of, we even elected people into the cookhouse, because that was an important area. So you tended to get somebody into the cookhouse that was reasonably honest and that wouldn't take too much food for himself or his friends, but would strive for a fairly equal distribution. That's that. Food was very important. I was one of the people involved in organizing and calling the strike. Yeah.
Did you hold any official position in the POW organization?
Well, what organization was there? You had your camp, which was split up into different companies, which again was split up into different so-called squads. And we had our own British company. So the only position that I had was, I suppose, as a kind of spokesman. Because gradually, as things settled, I found myself in a position sometimes where I was, I don't know, not just me, there were some others as well, who discovered that sometimes the Chinese way of looking at things, or their viewpoint, or their method of logic sometimes, Dean, is a little different from ours. And we discovered that if you sometimes approach a problem in their way rather than your way, you got results. You learn from that. Strange thing, very strange. Or sometimes in discussions or arguments, I mean, our arguments basically and fundamentally were about better conditions, or better food, better conditions, and more medical attention. These were the three basic areas that we argued and talked about. And to give you an example, I remember there was a point And it was after the food situation had improved. I mean, this sort of drastic situation I was explaining to you, that was certainly the case for the first 6 months, certainly. And for most of the first year. For most of that first year, people were dying, some people estimate, in Camp 5, 20, 30 a day. Mostly malnutrition, because the people of wounds had mostly died earlier. It was mostly malnutrition, and it was also due to what we came to call a disease called give-up-itis, where people just sat down and gave up. They saw no future in it, and they thought that we'd all die anyway of hunger. That mainly affected the younger Americans, mainly. Not in every case, but mainly. But after that first year, secondly into the second year, food began to improve to an extent. We had managed to delouse ourselves. The camp was right next to a river. In the summer, we could wash and swim, and we were reasonably clean. We tidied the camp up. We made proper latrines. Most of it we did ourselves. Well, I mean, it was our labor. The Chinese supplied the timber and stuff necessary, but most of it we did ourselves. And in the end, the British company in Camp 5 became a kind of model company. We even got rocks and so on, and we made little paths with the rocks down and whitewashed the rocks, a bit like an army barracks. And we whitewashed some of the houses. And because when you went out in the dark, and if you got the latrina somewhere, it was pitch black. There was no lights. And we found that this helped us to find a way if the rocks were painted white. And even inside the huts, eventually, people kind of decorated them or cleaned them up. And we set up sanitation squads to look out for things. And if somebody was caught short, then there was arrangements made to clean the mess and dump it. Whereas in the early days, if you were caught short, because we all had dysentery. And very often people got caught short, it was just left. So people were tramping all over it and everything. But within the company area, we got it all. We managed to organize ourselves. And we became a kind of model company to the extent that there were occasions when the Chinese brought people from other companies to show them the British company and what they could do and how they could organize themselves. So I think another advantage we had as well is that in the British company, I think I'd be correct in saying that the majority of them were older men. A lot of them had been in the Second World War. They were reservists, had been called in. They had had some harsh and tough experiences behind them. Even those of the younger element, like myself, either we had been reasonably well trained, in the case of the Marines, or we were war children. We'd been brought up during the war to expect one egg a week, and we'd been brought up in rationing. We were used to deprivations, we were used to shortages, and although we never suffered anything like we did in the prisoner of war camp, nevertheless, we were in some ways better mentally equipped than most of the Americans, whose standards of life were much higher than we were, who had never really been subjected to any form of harsh treatment. So there are reasons for these things. You might get the impression that I harp on it was the Americans who died. The only reason for this is. The reasons for it are based in concrete fact. It's a fact that either most of the British company were in the Second World War or had come through the war as kids, and I suppose we had a kind of different mental outlook. Whereas many of the Americans had come from, I suppose, a kind of